welcome to the Labrador podcast from Tales of Success Labrador Training. Hello and welcome back to the Tales of Success podcast with me, Vicky Sharp. Today we are joined by Ashley to talk about her adolescent but lovely Labrador called Baxter. Baxter really is the most loving and sensitive young man, and he's got an incredible life with his humans. They do genuinely care about his health, his welfare and his training, and would go the extra mile to help give this wonderful young man a brilliant family life. Amongst other things, we're going to be chatting about adolescence, challenges that are associated with that, some training, and also welfare of looking after a wonderful Labrador. So let's jump straight in and get started. Ashley, hello, welcome to you. How are you today?
Hi, I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having us on your podcast.
Absolute pleasure. So I know we've got you, but we've also got Baxter in the room as well. And I'm sure at some point he's probably going to put a paw on the microphone or give us a little whimper to say hello. So if people do hear that, that is Baxter himself. Right, tell us all about Baxter. For the people that are listening, give us a little rundown about who he is, how old he is, what sort of creature he is, and how wonderful.
So he is 15 months old now. He's a black lab. He's from a working line. We knew his dad. I'd always really liked his dad when we met him, thought he was a nice dog. And then when we heard that he was having puppies, I was desperate to get in there and get one of them. Because Oakley, who is his dad, was the stud dog, we didn't really choose Baxter. We just got given the puppy that was left, who hadn't been chosen. But we don't regret that at all, because he's wonderful. But I do sometimes wonder if maybe he didn't get chosen because he's on the quieter side of Labradors.
It's really difficult to know why dogs get chosen and why they don't. And, you know, I remember last time I chose a puppy, I had pick of the litter and I've got 9 puppies to choose from. And you do, you get quiet ones, you get boisterous ones. And I suppose everyone looks for different things. And maybe you could look at it as it was meant to be. He was always going to be yours anyway.
Yeah, no, 100%. I would have found it excruciating to have to choose. I love the thought that he was sort of destined, because I eat a plant-based diet and I'm sort of quite concerned with environmental issues. So I had been desperate for a dog for years before we got one, but I didn't feel like I could justify it. I didn't feel like environmentally I kept hoping for a situation that a dog would need me to save it. And then it would be mine. And like, it wasn't like I'd gone out and gotten a dog, it would be mine. And so when we got Bax, it was enough of a story that we knew his dad that I could justify it to myself that this was meant to be, this was our dog.
So how did you know Baxter's father then? What's kind of the story there? What brought you to that particular litter of dogs?
My partner and I work in a garden, like a private estate in the Cotswold countryside, and Oakley was owned by one of the ladies who worked on the estate, and we would often see him having escaped from the office and like rummaging in the compost pile, and he had a look on his face like that he knew he was being really naughty, and he was sort of delighted about it. And I just, like, having not had a dog before, I thought that was adorable, but now looking back, I maybe should have known that that's quite a lot of mischief and intelligence, and that that was a sign of trouble. But at the time, I just thought it was very endearing.
So you talk about that knowing look on his face, and I'm sure everyone listening to this can kind of think back to their dog doing that quite a lot. That's that cheeky look on their face, like they know they're not meant to be doing it, but actually the payoff is really good. So I think you've already said Baxter is your first dog, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Did you have any other experience with dogs prior to getting him? So maybe as a kid or looking after other people's dogs?
Yeah, so when I was a kid, my dad had a Springer Spaniel called Holly, but I didn't live with my dad, so I would only see that dog on weekends and things. And I really liked her, but I think I was just so small that I had no real understanding of the responsibilities and demands of training And when I was a bit older, I'd left home and my mum got a golden doodle called Leo, who was an enormous blonde. He was a bit of a legend. You know, it was such a distinctive looking dog. Everybody in the neighbourhood used to know him. And he was such an angel that I think my mum and me and everybody who knew him got lulled into a false sense of security about how easy it was to have a dog. Because I know my auntie went out and also got a golden doodle who turned out to, he's lovely, Monty, but he's a complete nutcase. You know, he's like full of energy, whereas mum's dog, Leo, was, I mean, almost untrained, but just behaved perfectly because he was really chill. So I thought I knew more about it before we got Baxter. And then we got him and I learned that there was a lot more to it. But in saying that, I didn't just wander out on a Friday and get the dog and have done no preparation. I sort of read solidly and watched so many YouTube videos beforehand. I felt as if I 100% knew everything that I needed to do. I knew so many numbers and things off by heart, like how many hours a day he needed to sleep and how much to exercise him according to his age and what I should be training him. And then we got him and I just realized that it wasn't an equation. You know, it wasn't as simple as put X in and Y will come out. He didn't want to sleep on his own. You know, he wanted you to sit with him to go to sleep. I had thought, your listeners are probably going to be laughing at me hearing this idiocy, but you know, when it said that puppies need to sleep X amount a day, I thought that he would need that and he would just lie down and go to sleep. But it wasn't like that at all. He would follow us around the house and try and sit on our feet and only sleep if we sat down with him.
I think you're right. You know, you said listeners will think I can't remember your words, think you're strange or something like that. But I think everyone does that. We all do it. We read books, we look at social media, we get advice from other people. But the trouble is not every dog is the same as another. And your mum's dog and your auntie's dog are good case in points there. You know, two similar dogs, but totally different temperaments, different needs. And the same goes for puppies. You might have a litter of 10 puppies, but they'll all need slightly different things. They'll respond in different ways. And absolutely, they're not this pre-programmed little puppy that come to you that just need to sleep for 18 hours a day. In reality, you end up tearing your hair out thinking, why on earth won't my puppy sleep? Why won't they just rest and relax? And I think the reality can be different from what people expect. Did you feel like you'd almost been hit by a sledgehammer when Baxter came along as a puppy?
Yeah. You know, one of his... I think it's, you know, I still feel sick thinking about it, how when we first got him home, I had heard so much about how you need to be quite firm to start with about where they sleep and not letting them sleep in the bed with you and things, because whatever you start with is what they'll go on with. And so our plan had been, and also I'd read that not to introduce them to the whole of your house straight away, you know, to keep it to one or two rooms to start with. And so our kitchen has a tiled floor. So my plan was that for the first few days of his life, he was going to live in the kitchen. That's where his little bed was. We'd put up baby gates. I'd put baby locks on the cupboard doors, thinking that he was going to get into cupboards. He's never shown the slightest interest in a cupboard. And our dining room is right next to the kitchen. So I was going to sleep in the dining room the first night so that I was close to him and he would know I was there, but not right next to him. And that he just howled and howled and howled and howled. And so then I moved into the kitchen and I had like a little camp bed thing. And even that wasn't, you know, it being in the same room with them wasn't close enough. You know, he howled. And looking back, I don't know why I felt like I had to be so strict. It was just, I was trying to do what everybody had sort of said, but it was his first night away from his mum and all his family. Like, he must have been. I just have this really vivid memory of him inching across the kitchen floor towards me, like trying to get as close as possible, and me trying to get him to stay in his bed, and then sort of eventually just kind of he crawled onto a little corner of the sleeping bag and was like, okay, I'll just sleep here. And I just wish I hadn't done that to him. It was all so unnecessary. But so yeah, the first few weeks nobody got very much sleep at all. So by the end of the first couple of weeks, we were going half mad with just lack of sleep and, you know, learning all these new things every day and taking him out to wee every 20 minutes and through the night as well. Obviously, I was taking him out for wees in the night. And then I think maybe after about 4 days, we figured out that he, I don't know why, but he was happy to sleep in his little travel crate if it was in the living room rather than the kitchen. Don't know what was different about the living room, but, you know, we were just trying everything by that stage. We'd had him in his bed upstairs by our bed, and he didn't like that. So eventually we'd hit on the travel crate in the living room with me sleeping on the living room floor, cooing and whispering to him through the crate door, you know, like, you're okay, just close your eyes. And that went on sort of lessening, but sort of every night for about 2 months, I slept on the living room floor and eventually was just moved the cushions further and further away from his crate. And then eventually I would just put down the cushions as if I was going to go to sleep in the living room, but I'd sneak out. And then eventually we didn't have to put down the cushions and pretend to him like I was going to be there. I don't know if that sounds to people like we were really over the top, but he howled all night. No one was getting any sleep. We had to do something. Whereas friends of ours who got a collie pup at the same time as us, collie pup called Fred, Fred loved his crate from the minute they got him home, would sleep in his crate through the night. But Fred took ages to get the hang of toilet training and, you know, kept having poo accidents in the house. Whereas I think Baxter did one wee in the house the day we brought him home, and then we ran outside carrying him and he sort of got it. He never, you know, we never had a poo accident in the house. So he just, you know, he was a nightmare with sleeping, but he picked up other things really quickly.
And I think you can kind of understand why some dogs do find it really almost traumatic in the first couple of weeks, because they've been taken from everything that is familiar to them. Their mum, their brothers, their sisters, the house setting they've come from. And they're suddenly with strangers in a new place. And you were probably, you know, you and the half were probably the only familiar things in that first couple of weeks. And some dogs just take a little bit more coaxing to feel calm and comfortable. And you did what was right for you at the time. Looking back at that, if you were to live your time again with Baxter, or even if you decide to get a new dog in the future, do you think you'd do anything differently?
100%. You know, their first week at home, because it was so hard to do what we did with the bed thing, it won't be any harder if he starts off with us, maybe on our bed, whatever, you know, like cuddled up on the sofa, sleeping on me, whatever that puppy wants that first week, they can have. It's honestly my biggest regret. I feel so sick thinking about how terrified he must have been, and I wouldn't let him, you know, come snuggle in and just give him what he needed. And then if we spend a few months working the dog away from us at night, then fine. At least they haven't started off their new life being really upset. So yeah, I would do that differently.
And I think that's a nice way to think about it. I'm very much of a similar camp, actually. I can't bear the thought of just locking a puppy away in a cage and just letting them cry it out. I think it's so traumatic for them. For me personally, I'd much rather build that confidence, that trust and that relationship in the first couple of weeks, and just have a really nice, settled, mellow dog. So now Baxter's been through all that, you know, he's of a certain age now. Let's talk about him in his current state. Where is he at his absolute happiest? What is his favorite thing to do? Where is it? And how brilliant is it?
Okay, so his favorite thing is charging through woodlands, jumping over stuff. Woodlands generally are brilliant, but if they can also be on a slope, like quite a steep hilled woodland, that's his absolute favourite, so that he can run up and down and charge and jump over logs and things like that. That's his walk. It's like I think of it as like a blowout walk, like where he goes and just gets to go mental and run free and charge about. And then if after he's let off the initial bit of steam, if there's some big stinky puddle or a little stream, that tops it off. That makes that walk perfect for him.
And as you're talking about Baxter being at his happiest, you're really smiling as well. So for your point of view, why is having him in your life so good? You know, how has it impacted on your life for good and for bad, I suppose?
I honestly don't know what we did with our time before we had him. He seems to occupy most of our day and be what we end up talking about and arranging our existence around. So I don't really know what we did with ourselves beforehand. He's scratching about on the carpet there. Every day, the sort of nicest part of my day is being out in the countryside with him. You know, like I laugh and joke with people that I spend quite a lot of my time smiling at a dog's bum, you know, because I just, he's trotting along on the path in front of me and I just sort of wistfully smile that his happy looking bum, because I can see whether he's like engaged in something or whether he's just cruising, ambling. You know, you can sort of tell from their behind profile what they're up to.
If you've got a dog with nose down and bum up, it usually suggests that they're having a great time.
Yeah.
Let's kind of look at the, you said you don't know what you did with your time before back. So I know a lot of your time is loving him, caring for him, but there's an element of training in there because you've not got to where you are currently, just winging it and hoping that he's just going to pick all this stuff up without dedicating time. So talk to us about your training from day one and whether you had like a rigid training schedule and whether that's continued into adulthood, the type of things that you've done that have been really beneficial to you.
Okay, I'm just trying to remember what we did when he was really small. So I think from, as I say, watching all the videos and doing all the reading, I had quite a lot of ideas that were pretty good actually about making him wait for food. And when he was smaller, we didn't used to feed him from a bowl at all. Like every meal was either games or scattering the kibble in the garden to get him to hunt for it, or, you know, training for the kibble, getting sits and downs and all the basic little commands. And then when he was a bit older, so then when he'd had his second shots, I think, we were able to go to puppy classes. And I had a plan. I had him booked on to two different sets of puppy classes, and my partner took him to one set and I took him to the other. And Andy's puppy class was pretty good, I think, but it was quite relaxed and quite unstructured. And the one I took him to is the, I think they call it Puppy University, which is really structured, really rigid. And by the time we went to the training, he knew most of the stuff that he was meant to learn at training. But I still think that the classes were really useful because it was the first time that he'd been in an enclosed space with lots of other dogs. It was in a sort of town hall thing. And he was mental. He was really overly excited and overly interested in the other dogs, which was particularly unfortunate because they were all tiny little breeds, like tiny little Cocker Spaniels and tiny little Jack Russell puppies. And he looked like Godzilla. you know, compared to them, he looked terrifying, and the owners were scared of him when he was trying to interact with their puppies. And I felt wounded and protective, like, oh, my baby is not allowed to play with the small babies. But that was the first sort of inkling that I got that his behaviour around other dogs, he was never aggressive, it was just really overexcited and really pulling towards them. And that has pretty much continued his whole life. You know, so we did puppy classes with him, and then we did adolescent classes in a different place again, which was good, just getting him to concentrate, focus on us around other dogs. But then eventually he got to, I don't know, was it about 8 or 9 months when we ended up phoning you?
Yeah, I think that was about right. He was, I think, just probably over that. I think it was around about sort of 10, 11 months that we got in contact.
Yeah, because honestly, he's kind of been a real... Oh, yeah, because the other thing that he started doing around that time... So he's good with us. He's so good in the house. We don't have any problems with him in the house. He's sort of picked up... I don't know if it's really training, but, you know, it's just his behaviour in the house is fine. He, you know, he obviously went through a puppy chewing phase, but just giving him chews, wood chews, antler chews, all that kind of stuff, and directing him away from the furniture... Like, apart from one little instant where he chewed the arm of the sofa, that was it. You know, nothing else in our house got destroyed that wasn't meant to get destroyed. But yeah, so around between sort of 8 to 10 months, it became obvious that this excitement about other dogs, he would run away. So his recalls were not bad from just general sniffing and things, but his running off to speak to other dogs and wanting to play with other dogs was really bad. Like, he wouldn't come back from that. And
were you able to pinpoint when that sort of happened? So I'm just wondering, you said about doing group classes with lots of other dogs. Do you feel that maybe in that setting, I suppose he thought other dogs were fun all the time? Did he have opportunities to have lots of fun with other dogs off lead? Had he had much interaction with them previously?
No. So we live in the countryside, and we can go for days, really, if I don't make an effort to take him into town or to take him to a park where I know other dogs are. We can go for quite a long time without seeing many other dogs. But if we do a walk, say like an hour or something round in the fields round about our house, we'll maybe bump into one or two other dogs. So I guess it was always this big burst of excitement, like, oh, another dog, run and speak to them. And, you know, I've got to take this chance. Who knows when my next chance might be. Yeah, so I suppose maybe when he was smaller, we should have taken him to the park more to let him play with other dogs. But then,
I think in our experience, when we socialize a puppy, and I'm not saying this is what happened with Baxter because I don't know, because it was before we got in contact. But a lot of people, when they look at getting a puppy, they want to encourage their dog to be really sociable with other dogs. And it's kind of seen that we need to let them play, have fun. Sometimes that can actually be the worst thing to do, because then dogs just get used to going and playing with every dog and having fun. And as much as we want them to have fun, we also want them to keep engaged with us. So often just kind of teaching them to master their set of skills, their training, their routines, while in close proximity and existence of other dogs, but without that need to play all the time, can often be more beneficial. So I don't think encouraging him to go and play with other dogs as a puppy a lot would have made your problem any easier, if that makes sense. I think it would probably have actually just made it a bit more exciting for him and increase that desire to go and play with other dogs. I mean, how has it panned out throughout his course of development? So often we'll see that during the adolescent phase, which is anything from kind of 6 months plus, that's when things become a little bit worse. And I suppose that ties in quite nicely with when you contacted me, doesn't it? The adolescent phase. Did you feel that it reached kind of a bad point when he hit adolescence? Did it get worse? Did it get better?
Yeah. So I've just remembered as well, when we got in touch with you, it's funny because they do something every day and then you don't notice a behavior when it vanishes. if you know what I mean. So he used to do that thing where he laid down. I don't know if you remember, whenever he saw another dog approaching, he would just lie down on the floor, which at first we were really delighted with because it seemed so polite and like he was, you know, being polite to the other dog. But eventually you sort of couldn't get him along. Like if you were in a sort of street situation or a park situation, and we realized that it was more about him controlling the situation and saying, I want to speak to that dog that I can see. I am going to lie down here and not move until that dog comes close enough for me to jump up and speak to them. And yeah, so I think we didn't act at that point because it sort of wasn't a naughty behavior exactly. But when we did decide to act was when he was running away and not coming back. Because then it felt dangerous. It felt like he might get run over or he might get lost. And also, I just didn't want him to be, it's antisocial. Other people don't want an enormous Labrador running up to their little dog. But to something that I've noticed, just a bit of an aside, is small dogs come up and behave appallingly to Baxter all the time. But because they're so small, it doesn't look threatening and everybody just smiles and says, oh, say hello. And to give Baxter his absolute dues, he's very relaxed about it and just lets them, you know, never responds badly or anything. Sometimes he starts jumping about because he wants to play as well. But if Baxter did that to another small dog, everybody would be outraged because it just looks different because he's so big.
I totally agree with you there. The pressure upon us as large breed dog owners is massive because as soon as our large breed dogs lunge, pull, bark, jump, any of these normal dog behaviors, people look at us and almost think, you need to get your dog under control. But next time, anyone that's listening to this, next time you go to the park, look at not every, but most cockapoos, most terriers, they actually behave in exactly the same way as I've just described, but because they're really little, no one really notices them. Because if a Jack Russell jumps up at you, they're going to get to your mid shin at best, and it's not going to mucky your clothes and anything like that. If a small dog barks, it's not quite as noisy and it doesn't seem quite as imposing onto other people's face. So I think we do have more onus upon us to kind of get on top of these things just because of that public perception. Have you ever had any encounters with other people that have kind of been a bit angry that Bax has run over to them or anything like that?
Yeah, 100%. So that was also another element of dog ownership that I hadn't anticipated, is that feeling of anxiety and dread when you're taking them out for a walk and they've maybe been going through a bit of a bad behaviour phase, so they're not giving good recalls and things like that, and you're almost nervous going out with them, like, oh man, what's going to happen today? Please, please let it be a good day where he doesn't do anything. And there's, I can think of one particular day, we went round Woodchester, which is a National Trust property around here that he absolutely loves. It's just an enormous wooded estate. And it's so big that I often walk there for, you know, an hour and a half and don't meet a single other person. And so it's a good place to take him and let him run off lead. And we were just coming back, and I just thought, because there's a point where you come back around one of the lakes and it's where you're more likely to start bumping into people. So I thought, well, I'll just walk to that tree and then I'll get him on the lead. And he did that thing, you know, where they sort of go rigid and look up. So he spotted something that I haven't spotted and then set off like a rocket. And so, yeah, the thing I can't see turned out to be a little dog. And the owner picked up their little dog. So the owner of the little dog wasn't impressed, but I think sort of understood that Bax was quite young and, you know, was just bouncing about, being enthusiastic. But I was then trying to get Bax on the lead. And so then he's dodging out of the way because it's now a game when I'm trying to grab him to get the lead on. So instead of trying to grab him, I just started to walk away because sometimes that works. You know, if I walk away and say, come on, Bax, we're going this way, especially if I do it with a bit of energy. And at that point, when I'm obviously in the middle of a situation trying to deal with it, an old man from the other direction who's walking along with his wife and his granddaughter, I imagine, who's nothing to do with it, he's not the dog owner, comes over and starts shouting at me, "You should have that dog on a lead." He's not even the dog's owner. It's like, what's it got to do with you, pal? And do you really think that coming and shouting at me just now is going to calm these overexcited dogs? So I just ignored him. And when I wasn't responding to him, he like walked around me to get in front of me to shout in my face, at which point I sort of went, yeah, you know, wanting to be stronger, but not wanting to swear at this guy in front of his granddaughter. And afterwards, I got back, you know, I got him away, and your heart's pounding. You know, it's such a kind of embarrassing, stressful thing. And I did wonder afterwards, would he have come up and shouted at me about having a dog on the lead if I was a 6-foot skinhead with tattoos on my forearms? I don't think he would.
Probably not. Yeah, no. Probably not.
But it was funny. It's obviously the sort of thing that happens quite a bit to them, because his wife is going, just leave it, tugging at his sleeve, trying to get him away. It just, yeah, so those sort of things become not commonplace. I'm not going to say that every time I go out with Bax, he's naughty, but it does happen from time to time.
Yeah, and I guess with the knowledge that you've got and the training that you've done, you're in a better place now where you can realise when it's going to go wrong and probably manage situations a little bit better. So if you've got a dog that's an excited greeter and they want to go up and run off and go to all these other people, how are you managing that day to day now? What's your advice to the people that will be going through the same thing? Because this is not just unique to Baxter. It's important that it's quite a common thing.
No. So, well, I suppose the first thing we did was come to you for help and advice with the training, and you helped us learn ways to keep him engaged with us when we were on walks, which has really helped. So I think before we'd sort of accidentally taught him to just run wild when we were out, like, this is the walk, this is your time to go and enjoy yourself. We hadn't really taught him that this was something we were doing together, and that he should, I mean, I fed him treats every time he came past me, you know, so I had encouraged the idea of checking in. But now when we're out on a walk, I have sort of 3 or 4 different things I do to recall him and make him think that I'm fun. So I blow the whistle and he comes back, and I either get him to do like a hand touch or a middle. He's got a sheepskin bungee chaser thing that he only gets to play with every now and again when we're out on the walk. So sometimes I recall him and he comes back and we have a mad game of tug for that. I recall him and we do a search for his scent pot, and then he gets a treat for finding it. So it's just the idea, like, I think I had fallen into the trap of only recalling him when I needed him to come back. So coming back was always fun ending. It was always like a bad thing to come back.
That's a very common mistake that loads of us make, because we normally call our dog back when the fun's ending, when they're in trouble, when we're about to go home, when we're going to put the lead on. It's really rubbish for a lot of dogs coming back to us. So finding those different ways to incentivize him is good. It makes it part of a fun routine. Bax is a nose-driven dog as well, right? He likes to get his nose down, have a good sniff. And scent detection was one of the things you did with us on our online course as well. Is that something that we've started to use to focus his sniffing? You know, you said you'll occasionally put the pot down for him to sniff out and things like that. Has he found that something that he likes doing? Is he not quite so fussed, or is he more of like a free sniffer?
I would say both. Like, he obviously really enjoys, I mean, he just loves being told he's a good dog as well. You know, like, he obviously enjoys it when you ask him to do something and then he does it and gets praise, you know, I'm so clever. You know, he obviously really enjoys that. But the scent detection, yeah, so we go on, that's the other thing that I've sort of developed over the last few months, is taking him on different types of walks. So some are massive run walks where, you know, he'll go a bit wild, but then others are more sniff walks, you know, where we go and he stays on the lead and just really slowly goes on sniffing. I think he does do a lot of sniffing when he's off the lead as well. But it was back in January, he hurt his paw and had to wear like a moon boot for a week and couldn't be let off the lead. And I thought, what are we going to do? Like, this dog needs 2 hours of exercise a day, and now he's not allowed to go off lead. Am I going to have to walk him for 8 hours a day? Like, what's going to happen? But it was a real revelation, because I just realized that I could take him and he would walk really slowly on the lead. So walks that would normally maybe have taken, walks that I would have discounted because they were too short, could now take 45 minutes with him just sniffing, you know, and me almost just standing. And so those walks, you were sort of saying, what did I do to prevent his naughty behavior before? So on the long walks where he's off the lead, I have to be as alert as possible to notice people in the distance, to listen to different sounds. Like, sometimes I will see a dog before he's seen it, and then I just get him on the lead and I just sort of head off the situation as much as possible. So no podcasts or any other distractions, no phone calls when he's off the lead is the general rule. Whereas the sniff walks, for him, they're very interesting, but for me, it's very tedious. So on the sniff walk, when he's on the lead, that's when I'm allowed to put some headphones in and listen to a podcast as he crawls along, sniffing every wee a dog has ever done on that stretch of path.
It's such an important thing for a dog to be able to do, because they fact find so much through their sniffing. And actually, just standing still, sniffing all these different new things does actually tire a dog out pretty well. It's amazing how tired a dog will get if they're just using their nose. So it's a great skill to do. What do you think life would be like with Bax if you had never done any training at all with him? Could you imagine an untrained Baxter and how your life would have panned out? What do you think it would have looked like?
I honestly just think he'd be in anguish all the time, because he would be getting told he was naughty, or, you know, it would constantly be like stopped from doing things and not getting the, would just be in sort of conflict all the time because he wouldn't know what was expected of him. He wouldn't have the same sense of security. Like, some of his little routines, when he was younger, he found getting left alone for any amount of time really stressful. Whereas now, you know, like, if I have to go to work in the evening or something, if he's had a good day, lots of walks, he's had some attention, I get out a dentist stick and walk upstairs with it. He runs upstairs, runs into his crate and lies down because he knows what's coming. And so then it's just, he's calm and happy. Yeah, I just can't imagine what life would have been like if we hadn't done that.
I think a lot of training, it's not just about teaching him a skill. It's about kind of getting him into a routine, which is predictable, and understanding that you've got his back, you're going to look after him, you're going to take him to these great places. And it comes about developing a great team. And if you're not part of that team with Baxter, he'll find his own stuff to do. And that's why training is important. It needs to be something that you both do together to get an amazing result. And also a heck of a lot of fun. You know, you enjoy the life in the countryside that you do, because actually you do have that engagement and you know what each other likes doing. Would you say you followed a particular method or style of training in the experience that you've had with Baxter? So things like, is it purely positive reinforcement based? Have you done any other weird and wonderful things that have worked well for you?
So it was entirely positive and rewards based. And a lot of what I had watched and read just kept reiterating this idea about, don't do anything to damage the bond with your dog, build the bond with your dog. But I think by the time we came to see you as a trainer, like, by the time we saw you, Bax knew a lot of what was expected of him, but was just choosing not to do it. By that point, he was physically very strong. I don't know if anybody's, well, lots of people, but if people think of Stranger Things, in the second series, there's the demi dogs, like those You know, and his, that's what his body looks like, this really muscular adult body. And I was just saying, Baxter, sit, don't do that. No, no, darling, I don't want to be dragged across the park. And, you know, it did come a point where I maybe had to make it a little bit clearer to him, stop, don't do that. And that was, it made a big difference. But, and then I think, yeah, just giving him clearer instructions, like an angry sound, not an angry sounding voice, not yelling at him, but a different tone of voice.
Yeah. And I think tone of voice is really important. So, you know, this is never about shouting and screaming at your dog, because we lose control if we do that. We've got to remain control of the situation. But think about it when you're at school. If you've got a class full of pupils that were misbehaving, our teachers would always make it pretty clear to us that we all needed to behave. And they weren't shouting and screaming at us, but we kind of got the angry teacher voice occasionally. And we knew that actually it was time to start behaving and doing what we knew we had to do. And I think sometimes just little things like that with our dogs really help them understand boundaries and what we want from them and what we don't. And we've got to use it effectively to have the right results. And I think Baxter understands that kind of mix, doesn't he, of happy, joyful, rewarding. But actually, if he's messing around a bit, we can just, you know, give him the angry teacher voice or whatever it might be, just to let him know that actually we want to kind of bring that behavior back to something that's a bit more acceptable. Do you think he copes well with kind of, I'm going to call it kind of black and white of training? So reward the good stuff, show a consequence when it's the bad stuff. And that consequence doesn't, again, it's not sort of beating our dogs, but it could be tone of voice. It could be taking a toy away. It could be a timeout, that kind of thing. Does he respond well to those kind of things?
Yeah, I think he probably does. But I think because just yesterday I had this realization that I have maybe drifted back into just avoiding any sort of conflict with him, you know, trying to make his world as rosy and never a harsh word. So all this behavior with him sort of running off and speaking to other dogs, I've been trying to avoid it. You know, we've been going to agility classes because I've thought, okay, we'll go to agility. It'll be fun and we'll be in this environment with other dogs and he'll learn to ignore them and focus on me. And all of these types of activities I've been doing all avoid me having to be cross with him or to tell him off. You know, I'm doing all these sort of passive things to try and shape his behavior. And we've been working and, you know, and so when... and rewarding him to focus on me as I have him on the lead and getting past other dogs. We've been working on this 4 months. Like, it shouldn't be news to him that this is the behavior that's expected of him. And then yesterday we were at a local beauty spot and there was two, I think they're Bretons. It's like a type of French hunting dog thing. They were jumping in and out of this stream, having a great time. I'd spotted them in the distance, got him on the lead and was trying to get him past without incident. And they came running over to us. And you can sort of tell by the owner's reactions whether this is going to be a problem or not. And when they saw us, the little girl said, "Mom, Mom, there's another dog." You know, they were panicking. So, and then their dog came towards us and it started growling at Baxter. And so I thought, oh, crap, I actually maybe really need to get him away quite quickly. You know, regardless of his behavior, it had all the hallmarks of a not great situation. And the ground was really muddy and slippy. So I was losing my footing. This dog is growling at us. And instead of accepting that he needed to come along with me, Bax was really pulling back towards the other dog. And so I pulled him. I pulled him much harder than I ordinarily would in that situation, because it makes me feel bad when I physically try and move him. But because of the mud and the dog growling, I was like, right, come on, we are going. And as it got him past and we were walking along, he was like looking up at me, giving me this look of like, whoa, what's the problem? You know, as if he was astonished, you know, like, you seem cross. What's the deal here? And I just thought, maybe I am not being as firm with this dog as I need to, if in his mind it is a new and surprising fact that he's not meant to pull to go and play to other dogs like that.
No, I think the positive in dog training should always, always outweigh any kind of negative, always, because we need to build that relationship. But, you know, just introducing pitch and tone of voice, as you've just described, you see actually that it can be effective if used correctly at the right time. Some dogs respond better to that than throwing a treat down the neck. Other dogs respond better to purely positive associations all the time. And it does very much depend on each dog. So what I'm not saying on this podcast is everyone needs to go out and, you know, raise their voice to their dog straight away, because it could send some dogs over the edge. But I think Baxter is one of those dogs that understands how communication can change. And it is something that I encourage you to weave into his training, you know, occasionally when it's really needed to give you that desired result. Ashley, I want to talk about some challenges that, you know, challenges in general with owning a Labrador, training a Labrador. And we've spoken about some of the training challenges that you've had. And at the beginning, we also spoke about a bit about perceptions. Like, when you got this puppy, it was going to sleep for X amount of hours a day and eat at certain times. Let's just kind of go back to that. Is the reality of owning this wonderful Labrador different from what you thought it would be? And we know the puppy stages were, but adolescent, is it totally different from what the books told you it would be? Is it what you expected? Had you expected all of these challenges and this great stuff that comes with owning a teenager?
So a lot of it is what I expected, you know, sort of healthy outdoor pursuits and cuddles and all that. But I think what I hadn't anticipated is that Baxter would have such clear emotions. So I think I thought he was going to be a much simpler creature. And as long as he was fed and played with, he would be happy. And I think he undoubtedly is happy. I think he has a great life, but he is really bonded to us and clearly prefers to have company than being left alone, and makes it clear if he feels like he hasn't had enough attention, you know, in the last half hour. And I just spend a lot of, well, I don't feel guilty anymore because we've now arranged our lives so that he gets left alone as little as possible. But it means I've had to change job, and other people think we're mad. Other people just think it's a dog. Just leave it in the house. Go to work, you know. And I don't know if their dogs are different and don't mind being left alone as much, or if they're just not tuning into the signals.
There's probably a mix of both out there. I think you are very much in tune with Baxter. And I think some people have dogs with different needs that are actually quite happy just to kind of be in the background and stay home all day while the humans go out. Doesn't mean that they're right, you're right, anyone's wrong. It just means different dogs, different situations. And I think you've got the dog you've got, and you are living with that. So, you know, you said you changed your job. I mean, that's not a decision you take lightly, right?
No, I was a gardener, and I had trained as a gardener. I spent years being a gardener. And when we were planning on getting the dog, I thought that this dog was going to have the most amazing life, because I thought it's going to come outside with me and be in beautiful green surroundings for 8 hours a day. It's going to run around and have all the walks, you know, what a blissful life for a dog. And then the reality was that he would dig and try and bite whatever I was working on, dig up the plants I'd just planted, try and bite the wheelbarrow, get upset when, you know, because my attention wasn't on him. He's like, why are we outside and you're ignoring me? What, you know, what's the deal? And so then instead of him being out in the garden with me, he would get, I mean, I tried to make it as nice as possible. I set up a little playpen in the mess room of the garden I was working in. So he had a bed and toys and chews and things. And I would get back to see him as often as I could. But it just wasn't working. He wasn't happy. I felt like he was getting really stressed. And I also just felt like I didn't get to spend enough time with him to know what was normal and what wasn't. So it reached a sort of fever pitch when he was really quite small. He got really sick one week and we've never found out what it was. He just started vomiting and, you know, for a few days was really, really sick. And that was really horrible and really frightening. And that was when I just realized, whatever happens, I need to spend as much time as possible with this little dog to learn what is normal, learn his routines so that I can spot what's abnormal, and also so that if he does get sick again and die, you know, which would just be the worst thing, I needed to have a clear conscience that I had done everything I could to make his life as amazing as it could be. And I felt it really strongly, like I had to do it. And thankfully, we were in a position that I was able to do that. But if, you know, if I hadn't been, I think I'd have tried to find him, and it would have broken my heart, but I think I'd have tried to find him a home where I felt like people could be with him, you know, for most of the day. And now he's getting a bit older, and I feel like he does sleep quite happily on his own for a few hours in the day. And so I'm going to head out back to work and do more normal jobs now instead of evening work.
With all that kind of adjustments that you've made, you've probably read stuff in books, and I'm sure everyone you speak to has an opinion of what you should do differently, whether you should just leave him at home all day or, you know, rehome him, whatever that might be. Castration is usually one of the things people talk about when we've got a male adolescent dog. So does Bax still have his bits? That's the first question.
So yes, this is very topical. Bax does still have his bits because I don't think he's the most confident. I mean, he is really confident, but he's a little bit clingy sometimes. But also just physically, we'd been told that it would be best if we could leave him intact until he was 18 months. So I was like really striving towards that. But the humping has gotten pretty intense over the last few months. And also this excitement towards other dogs is, you know, getting a bit out of hand. And you and other, you know, wise sources have warned us about the problem of the humping becoming a habit, so that even if we did get him castrated in the future, he might have already learned that habit by then and you'll just keep doing it. So last Thursday, Baxter went and got his hormonal implant. So it's like hormonal castration, which we felt might be a sort of good halfway point. We can assess whether there's going to be any negative results of castration, if we'll see positive results. So far, the only difference I would say is that he seems a bit sleepy.
Okay.
I haven't noticed anything else so far.
This that you talked about, this is what we'd refer to as chemical castration, is that right?
Yeah.
So usually chemical castration is around about 6 months that you'd see the effects last for. Was it done just simply by injecting a little chip into his neck, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it was. He didn't even notice. I thought that it might be much worse than it was. I just fed him chicken at the front and the vet just popped the needle in the back of his neck and he didn't even seem to notice. So, yeah.
And what did your vet tell you about chemical castration, what to expect? Did you get any advice either way, I suppose? Because I know some vets are really keen to do this as a first process. And we do also hear a lot of times vets are reluctant to do it because actually they think, the advice has previously been that I've heard that if you're going to do it, just go for the full procedure. don't worry about the chemical first. So what was the conversation like with your vet?
So we'd talked about that. The vet was, and we don't always see the same vet. We see, you know, it's the same practice, but we see different people, and they seem to have quite a good line on it every time we took him in for a checkup or whatever. They would ask, you know, what are your thoughts on crustacean? And they didn't try and push you either way, but they did advise. They were always quite clear that they don't recommend full castration until 18 months for dogs of Baxter's size, unless, you know, there were really negative behavioural issues that needed to maybe be resolved. And every time he goes to the vets, he treats it like a spa, and he's lovely to the nurses, and they give him biscuits and things. So they were always, you know, advising us, you know, you don't need to do this yet. You don't need to think about that yet. But they're obviously not seeing him out of the surgery where he's, you know, trying to hump every other dog that he sees. But the advice that they gave us about the chemical castration was that it would last about 6 to 8 months, that it might have no effect. Some people apparently report that it doesn't resolve any kind of humping issues or anything for their dogs. They advised us that he might get fat. I hope he doesn't get fat. We'll have to watch his food if he does. But yeah, they just said to watch, and it was just a sort of general advice about watching the site of the injection for a week to make sure it didn't get infected or anything. Yeah.
I think the important thing is you've gone for this chemical option. It's now just a case of being open-minded as to, is it going to have an effect? What are we going to do long term? And just almost take it month by month, and then have that conversation with, you know, your vet at the end of it to see what the best option for you is. There's loads of dogs out there that have had full castrations with no problems. There's loads of dogs out there that are still intact and live wonderful, happy lives, and, you know, don't have any challenges. So every dog will be different, but I think it would be good to see if there's any impact from the chemical castration.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about, in your experiences now, how you can help other people. So advice for other people, I guess. You've learnt from reading books and your own personal experience, because this is your first dog that you've had to look after, care for and train. What do you think the biggest misunderstanding is about having a pet Labrador?
I would say whatever amount of time and money you are imagining it's going to cost, quadruple it. So if you don't have much time, but I feel really cautious about saying, like, oh, if you don't have much money, don't get a dog, because it brings so much joy into your life. Why should you, you know, not have that? You know, I don't want it to be only really wealthy people.
Yeah, and I think that's right, but we've got to be realistic, actually. Yeah. You need to get medical treatment for your dogs. I would argue that you need to spend the money to train your dog.
Yeah.
You need to give them enrichment. You need to do things that actually do cost money. So there's always going to be that realistic cost implication involved, as there is with anything in this life.
Mm-hmm.
There's loads of free stuff that you could do with your dog that gives you that enjoyment. But realistically, we spend a lot of money buying our dogs, and that needs to translate into the rest of their life. So I think there is merit in saying that actually it is a costly thing, right? You know, unexpected vet bills and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and just, I hadn't thought that. So if money was a concern, maybe you could look at getting a smaller dog, because all joking aside, Bax eats a huge amount of food, and I want to try and make sure that he lives a really long life. So we buy the best quality food that we can afford. But if he was a Jack Russell, he would eat a cup of it a day. It would, you know, it would go a lot further. But because I have basically become obsessed with him, and he is my main hobby and joy in life, all the money that we spend on him just feels like money that I am spending on things we want to do. But yeah, don't count on the dog just being sort of like a friendly cushion, you know, that kind of gets fed and then ignored. I think a lot of people have a vision of a happy family unit, and the dog is this kind of undemanding, almost like a handbag, whereas more think about it as having a child. I have, maybe all dogs won't be like that, but I have definitely found Baxter to be as intense and as demanding as I think people having children is.
Yeah. And they often are not simple creatures. You know, we often have that vision. They're just going to be the nice dog that plops themselves on the sofa and chills out, relaxes all day, and we go for one walk. But it, I would say that's a rarity to have that simple creature that, you know, we kind of maybe think about. If you could give someone just one piece of advice. So let's think about someone that was in your position 10, 12 months ago, and they've got this new puppy in their lives. What key bit of advice are you going to give them from your learned experience?
It's really difficult to accept that, but just keep trying. Like, there was days where I honestly just felt like I could cry, because you felt like, oh mate, just give me a break. We've been working on this and working on this. Why are you being so naughty? And you're often really tired as well, because they're keeping you up at night and things. And the behavior that is driving you mad at that minute, a lot of the time, they, with work, I'm not saying it just vanishes, but it does fade. And then you don't even remember it. So now he's 15 months, we don't think about puppy chewing. It doesn't even enter into my head, you know, or whatever the problem is that day. So just keep going. And but also, I think more importantly, stop for a cuddle. So sometimes it can just feel like another thing that you're failing at. You know, it's this dog, you're trying to train it, and why isn't it working? And I'm doing all these things. But like, if they've been naughty out on their walk, but that's over now, just let it go. And then if they want to be cute and cuddle you when they get home, just enjoy that. This is why I very rarely get things done that I should be getting them done, because now if Bax comes up and is doing something really cute, or if I just see him lying on the floor, I'll often just stop and crouch down and give him a cuddle. And some people could see that as wasting time, but I honestly don't think on my deathbed I'm going to regret that. And it's probably lowering my, you know, all these stress, endocrine, all these hormones and things like that. 5-10 minutes cuddling the dog is probably good for my health. It's probably good for your health. So that's the advice I would give them. Enjoy the good bits and just try and forget the bad bits as quickly as possible. And the only thing that makes the whole experience a bit more stressful than it probably needs to be is other people's opinions, you know, worrying what other people think about you and your dog and how you're doing it, and judgment. And it's actually just good in life generally. Like, so if you can learn to be happy and enjoy your dog and ignore what other people are thinking about you, that's good for you to take into your life more generally. I think to worry less about what other people are thinking about you. But the reason, like, if your dog is actually biting people, then yeah, you need to worry about it.
Do you know what? I have nothing else to say on that point, because you just said that perfectly. And honestly, that advice that Ashley has just given you is spot on. Enjoy every single moment of it. Ashley, I'm going to round it up there and just thank you so much for joining us, sharing your story and your experiences with Baxter. I'm going to encourage you just to keep continuing just to build that amazing relationship that you've got with him, and just keep enjoying him. Thanks for joining us. Find out more by checking out talesofsuccess.com or search at Tales Success on your social channels.